So even if you've never seen an episode of the TV series, even if you've never listened to the 1940s radio serial drama, even if you're only born in the last, 10, 15 years, you've probably at one time or another heard the phrase, "Father knows best," right? Well, it's an iconic part of American culture for sure, and that series was broadcast around the world. But what I want to talk about today is the Bible. The Bible is God's Word, and it was inspired by the Father himself, right? So, therefore, if the Father knows best, then by association, the Bible knows best. And we want to look at a few places in the Scriptures, actually many places in the Scriptures, where there seem to be hidden gems of astoundingly good science throughout the Bible. Now, the Bible is not a scientific textbook. It's our guide for life. But where it talks about science, it is authoritative, and it is 100% accurate from beginning to end. Whatever it's talking about, it's true. So, not much background is needed to understand what we'll be talking about, but basically the Bible is God's word of truth. Knows means to have knowledge of, right? Best means it's superior over all others. Well, the word science comes from the Latin word scientia, which means to have knowledge. So, when the Bible knows best, it certainly has some good science in there. Now, Romans 1:20 says, "The invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse." So Paul says to the Romans that we can understand God better by studying the things we see around us through science. So let's take a look at some science in the Bible. We're going to start with a very simple one. In fact, let's start at the very beginning. The foundation of the entire universe can be found in the first verse of the Bible, Genesis 1:1. It says in Hebrew, "Bereshit bara Elohim et hashamayim ve'et haaretz," or "In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth." So, does the Bible know best? Is that good science? Well, the very origin of time, space, and matter can be found in that first verse. It's interesting to note that the origin of matter is not addressed by the Big Bang Theory. It attempts to explain how time and space came into existence, but it doesn't tell us about how we got all of the matter in the universe, and it's not a good theory about how the origin of space and time either. So, the first verse says, "In the beginning," well, there's time, "God created the heaven," there's space, "and the earth," well, there's matter. So you have the origin of time, space, and matter in the very first verse of Scripture. But let's take a look at how the fabric of space might function based on Einstein's theory of relativity. And this is a simplistic explanation, a two-dimensional model based on a fabric of spandex and how matter influences that. So I want to show you a little video. In 1915, Albert Einstein published his General Theory of Relativity, which describes gravity as a geometric property of space and time. Space-time, or the fabric of space. Now, according to the theory, objects composed of matter deflect space-time to an extent proportional to their mass, heavier objects deflecting space-time more, and lighter objects less. Now, gravitational attraction is explained as objects simply following the curvature of space. While there are many other theories that attempt to explain gravity, Einstein's theory may be the most complete. Now what I've done is I've stretched a piece of spandex across a circular frame. The spandex is roughly representing a two-dimensional model of the fabric of space-time. So let's take a look at how objects react as we place them on the fabric of space-time and give them a little angular momentum, sending them in orbit around a central mass. You can see right there the two objects rotating around each other, which in turn are rotating around a central mass. And this is the way that space works, space-time works, based on Einstein's theory. With an elliptical orbit in the frictionless environment of space, angular momentum is conserved, which keeps objects in continuous orbit. So, of course, it continues to draw closer to the center. But this right here is how you can see where they sent the probes to the moon using a free return trajectory. So you see it slingshots around, you send it from the Earth and it slingshots around the moon and returns back to us. This is another video from NASA where you can see the same thing. Basically, the gravity of the moon catches the probe, slingshots it around. It almost escapes back out again, but the gravity is too strong, and it's pulled back in, slowly but surely, until it reaches an actual, more of a circular orbit around the body. So, Proverbs 8 says, I was set up from everlasting, speaking of wisdom, while as yet he had not made the earth, nor the fields, nor the highest part of the dust of the world. That's the King James. If we were to take it to the Hebrew, where it says highest part, that means chief, like Rosh Hashanah, the head of the year, or the chief of the year. The same Hebrew word is used. So it's basically the chief dust of the earth. So what's the chief dust of the earth? What's everything made out of? What about? That's right. The atomic structure of the universe. But let me ask you this. Maybe there's something else that we've yet to discover in science. Because we already know of hypothetical quarks and leptons in the subatomic level. Perhaps this could be talking about atoms, or perhaps it could be talking about something yet to be discovered in science. Nevertheless, the Bible knows best. Now, one other interesting thing about this verse is talking about wisdom. Solomon's talking about wisdom here in the first person. And I think that's interesting because he was, of course, a very wise man. And through the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, he considered it appropriate to talk as wisdom herself. Now, Job 39 says, does the hawk fly by thy wisdom and stretch her wings toward the south? For centuries, the smartest inventors in the world studied birds and hoped to one day be brilliant enough to accomplish manned flight. They tried for a long while. They were finally able to accomplish it, but not nearly as efficiently as the birds of the air. These creatures were made for their specific function. So let's take a look at the Arctic tern. Jeremiah 8 says, yea, the stork in the heaven knoweth her appointed times. It goes on to say, and the turtle dove, and the stork, and the swallow. Well, the Arctic tern is a seabird, often called a sea swallow, with an estimated global population of about 1 million. Okay, they live about 20 to 30 years. They mate for life, and they take a particular course on their migration paths, north and south, that often varies from year to year to take advantage of prevailing winds. But let's take a look at what they do. They might start up here in Greenland or the Netherlands, somewhere like that, and they'll take a southern course along the western shores of Africa. Then at the southern tip of Africa, many times they'll turn towards the east, head over to Australia or even New Zealand. Then they'll turn south, spend their our winters in Antarctica before they turn north, take an entirely different path, many times up the coast of the Americas, and end up back in the same spot. 56,000 miles annually. And again, they live for 20 to 30 years. That means that over the course of their lifetime, they will travel 1.5 million miles. And this just happened by accident. The sea swallow knows her appointed times, and when it's time to move south and time to move north, they have it inherently built inside of them. It didn't happen by accident. The Bible knew best long before we could use trackers and banders to actually follow their migration routes. Now, Luke 12, 24 says, consider the ravens, for they neither sow nor reap, which neither have storehouse nor barn, and God feedeth them. How much more are ye better than the fowl? Well, let's take a look at how special the fowl of the air is. And I want to take a look at the hummingbird as a perfect example, because I consider that to be God's little wonder. The hummingbird is the smallest bird on planet Earth, the smallest of all warm-blooded creatures. They can fly forwards, backwards. They can hover. At birth, they weigh less than a post-it note. They're that small. They're able to detect sugar content just by tasting it. And if it's not 10% sugar when they go to this flower and collect the nectar, they'll go to another flower. Because they know that anything less than 10% sugar content could not sustain their super fast metabolism. Because they have a heartbeat of 1,200 times a minute. Think about that. If our heart beats several hundred times a minute, we're in big trouble, right? But this bird, 1,200 times a minute. Now, because of this, their metabolism is so fast that on a long, cold night, they simply would not have enough energy to sustain them through the night. They can't go to flower all day and all night. They have to rest sometime. But because of their super fast metabolism, they would simply die at nighttime if they didn't have a system called torpor. And this is a miraculous system built inside of them that shuts their metabolism down to 1/15th of normal and slows their heart rate from 1,200 times a minute to 35. And the next morning, they wake right up and they fly away again. Again, it did not happen by accident. Their eyesight is incredible. They have two fovea in each eye, which allows them to see and focus in two points, straight ahead and side to side, simultaneously, unlike our peripheral vision, which allows them to fly through branches at 35 miles per hour without smacking into the side of one. They have a two-step lung system, which allows them to utilize all of the oxygen in their lungs. They have a weight reduction, like many other birds. Their bone structure is hollow. They fly long distances by themselves, several thousand miles round trip in migration, and yet they've been found at the exact same backyard hummingbird feeder the next year. And nobody knows how they do that. I talked to friends who are commercial airline pilots, other pilots. I said, if we put you in a plane and sent you several thousand miles round trip, could you find your way back to the exact same spot? And they said, we couldn't do it. But hummingbirds do it alone. Their parents don't teach them. They don't travel in flocks. They find their way from this area, probably, down to Central America and back to the exact same feeder. And nobody knows how they do it. I had the opportunity of hosting a documentary called Refracted Glory about hummingbirds from a creation perspective. The only thing ever done like it in time. And I want to play you a little clip about hummingbirds' color because they shine through refractive glory. So the refractive nature of their feathers allows the brilliant colors to show. So let me let you take a look at that. Yep. Let's see if we can get it to play.
It's more than just the thickness of the film, although that plays a role too. But there appear to be almost like little prismatic structures in the surface of the feather that are very, very small, measured in microns.
Under the thin outer layer of keratin, melanosomes containing melanin pigment are organized into a consistent layer near the surface. The iridescent colors of hummingbirds are caused by light being refracted through each layer and reflected back. Some feathers will reflect light in only a few directions, while others reflect in the general direction and always appear similar in color. Amazingly, the iridescent structural colors also tend to be restricted to the outer portion of a feather, where it's not overlapped by other feathers. Structural colors are not just scattered light, like the refraction that we see in a rainbow or soap bubble. These feathers are designed to reflect very precise colors, and even the tiniest change in composition will alter the appearance.
And the thicknesses are so precise, and there's a little variation in different thicknesses that you get different colors reflected. And what's particularly beautiful is that because they are structural colors, they're very pure, they have a deep luster, they don't fade like pigment colors. They're very beautiful colors. And they're also iridescent colors, which means the color changes with the angle of view. So as the bird moves and flies, you see a shimmering effect as the color changes. And those colors are so beautiful that there are hummingbirds named after their color, like the ruby-throated hummingbird, or the blue-throated hummingbird, or the violet-crowned hummingbird. But the colors are really beautiful to behold.
So the pigment plus the prism effect gives you this variety of colors, which is absolutely incredible. I don't think there's any bird quite like a hummingbird, particularly our ruby-throated that we did here in North America. That was such a gorgeous display of color. And why? Why all these colors? Maybe the female hummingbirds like that. I've heard that that's a possibility. But you know, when I look around in nature, I see beauty everywhere that I have to ask myself, why does it have to be so beautiful?
Engineers often produce beauty for beauty's sake, in, say, a motor car or a bridge or a building. And that's what I see in the hummingbird. I see beauty for beauty's sake. The hummingbird doesn't need those beautiful colours for survival. And I see the hand of the Creator in that.
It's pretty spectacular, isn't it? And these are just one example of the fowl of the air. And you think that our Father cares for them. Well, He cares for us even more. And you may think, well, they look like they're privileged, like they have all of these things that we don't have, tophobia and hollow bones and a torpor and a heartbeat that will allow them to do remarkable things. The thing is, they have exactly the right features to accomplish the exact tasks that they were placed here on this earth to accomplish. And the same holds true for you. So let's take a look at ourselves for a second. Psalm 139 says, I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are thy works, and that my soul knoweth right well. Did you know the most complex computer ever designed was built in only 9 months? Do you have an idea what I'm talking about? The human brain. That's right. 100 billion neurons communicating with 100 trillion cells at around 250 miles per hour through our bodies right now. That's much more sophisticated than the entire World Wide Web. And as long as you use your brain, unlike what science believes just 50 years ago or less, your brain continues to produce new neurons. That's right, it's replacing. Well, we shouldn't be surprised, because Romans 12 says, be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. Our minds are being renewed, and as long as we keep them on the right thing, they will be renewed to our benefit so that we can more efficiently praise the Creator. Now, Psalm 139 says, thine eyes did see my substance, yet being unperfect, and in thy book were all my members written, which in continuance were fashioned when as yet there was none of them. So, what is this telling us here? Talking about, in thy book, members were written and continuance were fashioned? DNA can be expressed as a written language that creates the blueprints that makes you who you are. And in fact, DNA is like a letter, a combination of four base pairs that make up any sequence that will create you. You're very individual. Now, geneticists tell us that there are trillions upon trillions of combinations that make up DNA. And your DNA sequence would fill 1,200 encyclopedia volumes. That's in you right now. But if that's not impressive, get this. Your entire DNA sequence, that 1,200 encyclopedia volumes, can be found in nearly every cell of your body. That means in you right now, there's enough information to fill up all 35 million books of the Library of Congress, just in you. We're fearfully and wonderfully made. The Bible knows best. Several things are completely unique about you. Of course, your DNA is one of a kind. Your iris and retina contain unique patterns that no one else has. No two palm prints are alike, and each fingerprint is unique. Now, what I want you to do, look at your thumbprint right now. You see that? Of course, you have two separate ones. Both are completely unique. Not another one like it on planet Earth. You know, that makes you somebody. We're special. We're very special. Leviticus 17 says, the life of all flesh is the blood thereof. Well, now, there are a few creatures that don't have blood. The vast majority of us, if we run out of blood, we run out of life. Now, most of the creatures that don't have blood, all of them that don't have blood, don't have flesh. So when it says the life of all flesh is the blood, it's completely accurate. Things like sponges, they don't have blood, but are considered life forms. So let's take a look at this scripture and see if the Bible knows best. It was not very long ago, a few hundred years ago, when bloodletting was a common practice. And it's estimated that over 125 ounces of blood was left from George Washington just before he died. Now, let's go back one. What does it say? The average body contains 160 ounces of blood, and the life of flesh is the blood. And they took out 125 ounces out of George Washington, and he died, and they wondered why. It seems like the Bible knew best. He should have been reading that book. Don't approach your near kin. Many instances in early biblical history of people marrying cousins or close relatives, and it doesn't seem to be a problem. But all of a sudden, there seems to be something different. The Bible seems to be contradicting itself in Leviticus 18:6. It says, "None of you shall approach to any that is near of kin to him." Well, why? Why wasn't it a problem before now, and why all of a sudden are you saying this? Well, until 100 years ago or less, we didn't know anything about DNA sequencing or the genetic pool of information that we're all made from. Because Adam and Eve started out with a 100% pure genetic code. And after the fall, after sin was introduced, copy errors in the DNA sequence began to worsen. Well, what happens when you marry a close relative is basically the DNA sequence overlaps for their children, and any time that there's a genetic error, that error is worsened where the DNA sequence overlaps. So, at the appropriate time in history, God said, nope, we populated the earth to a point where there's a wide variety of people on the earth which can produce a wide variety of genetic sequencing and keep this generation alive. And that's what he did. And that's what the Bible said, and it's 100% accurate. Leviticus 11 says, "Every earthen vessel wherein to any of them falleth, whatsoever is in it shall be unclean, and ye shall break it." The next verse says, if it's clothing or something like that, you need to wash it. But if it's earthen pottery, it says break it if a dead thing dies into it. So why? Why can't we just wash it and reuse it? Well, until germ theory, we didn't know. But the Bible knew best. There's no telling how that thing died, what disease it had, and the microbes would seep into the cracks in the earthen pottery, or the porous nature of the earthen pottery, and when you ate out of that, it would spread a disease, right? I've been to Israel, to the Holy Land, about a dozen times, and most of the pottery that we find over there is not glazed, so it's not sealed. So this was absolutely necessary to inhibit the spread of diseases, but they did not even know about germ theory at that point. So he says, break it. The Bible knew best. Dealing with contagious or transmitted diseases, Leviticus 13 says, all the days wherein the plague shall be in him, he shall be defiled. He is unclean. He shall dwell alone without the camp. Why without the camp? Up until the 1800s, the miasma theory was popular. The miasma theory is the idea that Black Death, cholera, other diseases like that were caused by poisonous air. Which, you know, you have germaphobes today. I'm a little bit of a germaphobe, I have to admit. You know, you go into a public restroom and but I guess before germaphobes, you had miasmaphobes. Those who were afraid of poisonous air. So I can just imagine how that would go. I don't think the generation would last too long. It's like, hey, Bubba, I hear the flu's going around. Oh, really? Tell me when it's over. Wouldn't last too long. No. But it says separate the disease outside the camp to inhibit the spread of the disease. The Bible knew best. Dealing with germs and microbes again, Leviticus 15 says bathe in running water. Well, washing in still water is much less efficient at removing microbes and germs, but the Bible knew best all along. Louis Pasteur, of course, was instrumental in research in germ theory, but this is something that has been so powerful. Before this time, surgeons would not wash their hands before operating, and in fact, they would wear filthy operating gowns full of the blood and bodily fluids of the people that they had worked on previously because it made them look like they had more experience. Huh. I'm telling you what, we should really pay more attention to this book right here because it's full of good science. Let's take a look at Job 26. It says, he stretcheth out the north over the empty place and hangeth the earth upon nothing. Does the Bible know best? Well, some ancient cultures believe that what we're standing on right now is a flat earth, and this flat earth rested on top of a bunch of giant elephants, of the backs of giant elephants, and those giant elephants were standing on top of a giant turtle, and that giant turtle was floating in a giant pool of water. That's one of the popular beliefs in ancient cultures. But the Bible says that God hangs the earth upon nothing. And science has indeed shown that earth is suspended on nothing with space all around it. What about the circle of the earth? Again, creationists many times get attacked by atheists. They say, oh, you're just a bunch of flat earthers, right? No. Isaiah 40 says, it is he that sitteth upon or dwells over the circle of the earth. Now, the spherical shape of the earth is not something new. I don't know if y'all were taught in school, 1492 Columbus sails the ocean blue, right? Were you taught that Columbus had to convince his crew members, no, we're not going to fall off the edge of the earth? Did they teach you that? Mm-hmm. That's what they taught me. That's not true. Not only did the Bible predict it or tell us, but also Aristotle, using lunar eclipses thousands of years before Columbus, showed that the earth was spherical. So let me play you a little video clip. Those who were educated about Columbus's voyage to the New World can often recall a few basic details from their days in school. Apart from the often repeated line, in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue, a majority might recall that Columbus wanted to prove the rest of the world wrong in assuming a flat earth. But just a minute, is that bit of knowledge founded in reality? A look at lunar eclipses enlightens us with the real history. Lunar eclipses occur when the Earth, Sun, and Moon align, causing the Earth's shadow to block the light from the Moon. The ancient Greeks observed this shadow, and Aristotle, living in the 4th century BC, noted that while some of his contemporaries believed in a flat Earth, lunar eclipses held one of the keys to showing its true shape. Either then the Earth is spherical, or it is at least naturally spherical. The evidence of the senses further corroborates this. As it is, the shapes which the moon itself each month shows are of every kind, straight, gibbous, and concave. But in eclipses, the outline is always curved, and since it is the interposition of the earth that makes the eclipse, the form of this line will be caused by the form of the earth's surface, which is therefore spherical. Yes, the spherical shape of the earth was known long before the time of Christopher Columbus's voyage. Around 2,000 years before, the prophet Isaiah referenced the circle of the earth with the following preface. Have ye not known? Have ye not heard? Hath it not been told you from the beginning? Have ye not understood from the foundations of the earth? I'm David Reeves. Truly, the heavens declare the glory of God. In other words, you have to be pretty dense to not understand this. The Bible told us all along that the earth is a sphere, if only we would just believe it. Now, the Bible knows best. What about where it talks in Job 40, where it talks about Behemoth? It says, behold now Behemoth, which I made with thee. He eateth grass as an ox. Lo now, his strength is in his loins, and his force is in the navel of his belly. So, many Bible commentators said perhaps we're talking about an elephant here, because indeed he has a lot of strength in his belly, right? But they forget to go on, where it says, he moveth his tail like a cedar tree. That does not look like a cedar tree to me, I just have to tell you. But does the Bible know best? There's nothing that is alive today that moves its tail like a cedar tree. But maybe you heard the headlines of just a couple of months ago. Dreadnoughtus, the Titanosaurian sauropod, has been discovered, 85 feet long from head to tail, weighing over 10 adult elephants. You can see a picture of a person standing next to this representation of this thing, but look at that tail. You think that tail could be moved like a cedar tree? I think so. The Bible knew best. What about in 2 Peter 3? It says, whereby the world that then was, being overflowed with water, perished. Well, the global flood account in Genesis 6 speaks of a deluge that literally destroyed the earth. It reshaped the continents, reshaped the earth. It was a catastrophe. But if the flood literally changed the face of the earth about 4,000 years ago, then surely there's some sort of evidence, right? Well, yes, there's quite a lot of evidence, and it can be found in the form of catastrophism all over the Earth in the geological features. A good example is the Grand Canyon. In fact, in recent history, in 1980, Mount St. Helens erupted, and as a result of that eruption, 2 years later, there was a smaller eruption which sent a mudslide down, which carved a 1/40th scale model of the Grand Canyon in one day, caused by the breaching of the mud from the Toodle River over a one-day period of time. That's pretty quick. And atheistic geologists, they say, oh, well, you know, it is kind of compelling. It's interesting. If we didn't see this happen in one day, we would probably tell you that the layers here are, you know, a few million years old and a few million years old and a few million years old. But it's different at the Grand Canyon. That was caused by the water of the Colorado River slowly eroding this massive canyon. And I always think it's interesting to note that a 1/40th scale model of the Grand Canyon was formed in one day. And how many days did it rain at the time of Moses? Oh, 40. It's perfectly obvious when you think about some of these things. Now, what about clams in Kansas? Do they indicate catastrophe? I recently had the opportunity to participate in a paleontological dig in western Kansas, 1,000 miles from the nearest sea, 2,500 feet above sea level, and everywhere I stepped, I was stepping on tens of thousands of fragments of clams, fossilized clams. Where did they come from? Why were they there? Some of those clams were in the closed position. Now, it's interesting to note that when you find clams in the closed position, if you walk along the seashore, what do you typically find bivalves? You find halves, right? Seashells. But some of these, and many others around the world, are closed, which means that they were buried under tremendous amounts of mud, heat, and pressure quickly before they had the chance to open up. Because that's what clams do when they die. The muscles that hold the two shells together relax, and it opens up. And then over the next course of the next week or so, the muscles disintegrate and they separate. And that's what we normally find. Not in the fossil record. In fact, you find sea fossils on Mount Everest and other of the many tall mountains around the world. And atheistic geologists, they have an explanation for this. They say, oh, we know. Yes, you're absolutely correct. You see, but what you don't understand is Mount Everest and these other big mountains, they used to be on the seafloor. And they slowly inched their way up onto land, onto dry land. And then they crawled up to their current position. And that's the reason you find sea fossils on top of these mountains. And they call what we have faith. It seems to me that it takes a lot more faith to believe something ridiculous like that than it does to believe that there was a global flood that caused many of the geologic features that we see today. Now, bent strata is another excellent example, and it's found all over the world. Many sites have these smooth folds that bend at extreme angles, and that's evidence of catastrophism, not gradualism, not millions of years of evolution. In fact, to do this, you have to have massive amounts of pressure, heat, and soft, pliable material. Let me explain that. You've got all these layers of strata right here. Well, everybody knows what plywood is. Multiple layers of wood laminated together to make them hard. And then it hardens once they're glued together, and you've got the same thing. Now, of course, this is miles of sedimentary rock, which means laid down by water, incidentally. But we just got just a little bit, because I'm not strong enough to break another one. But let's see what happens when we try to bend this and match this formation, right? Because we should be able to do that. Uh-oh. It doesn't bend, it breaks. And in fact, that's what happens with rock as well, once it's hardened, once it's lithified. So that means that these things had to have been bent while they were still soft, still pliable, and that means that they must have been laid down in the same time period during or after Noah's flood, while there was still massive amounts of mud and sedimentation being hardened. Again, perfect evidence. The Bible knew best. The world that then was being overflowed with water perished. Another great example is polystrate fossils. And I had the opportunity to visit an excellent preserved example of a polystrate fossil earlier last year. It was featured in National Geographic magazine in the 1970s, but then people forgot about it. They forgot where it was. They didn't know how to get back to it. I was able to find a park ranger or land management ranger who could take me back to this area, very remote in the mountains of Tennessee. And once you get there, it's astounding. It's this huge fossilized lycopod tree, 25 feet tall, turned to stone in the midst of a cliff face with multiple layers of strata. Now, you ask an evolutionary geologist, so tell me about this strata here. Oh, they would say, well, this to here is about 10 million years. Each of these layers represents a few million years, and you've got about 10 million years of buildup right there. And you tell them, well, okay, now let me just ask you another quick question because I'm not fully understanding this. So you're telling me that this tree stood upright and lived for 10 million years while dirt slowly formed around it? Oh, well, we've found a solution. It is a catastrophic local flood. And that's what they say. That's the only thing they can say. They say, okay, it was a catastrophe. It had to have been very quickly. We see that now. But it was a catastrophic local flood. They simply cannot admit that the Bible is true, even though we find evidence all over the world. Let's talk about Leviathan, the serpent in the sea. Isaiah 27 talks about the dragon that is in the sea. Job 41 says, canst thou draw out Leviathan with an hook? None is so fierce that dare stir him up. His breath kindleth coals. That's some pretty bad breath there. And a flame goes out of his mouth. Now, I'm going to tell you, when I read this out, many people, once I get to the flame goes out of his mouth, people say, oh, that's a fairy tale. That's something you see in a movie. That can't be true. The Bible certainly can't know what it's talking about right there, but I'm telling you what, it can. And I want to look at a creature that is still alive today, called the bombardier beetle. It has three chambers in its abdomen. Two of those chambers contains two different chemicals. Those chemicals, when they're combined together, react with each other, and they form a scalding hot liquid chemical that shoots out of their backside and will repel anything that's trying to attack it. Let me show you how it works. This is a video. Look, the tweezer's going to come down. It's going to gently pinch the leg of the bombardier beetle. Bam! And there you go. Let me back it up and do it once more. And look at the precision. It can actually aim its cannon, and it can hit exactly where it's being attacked. Watch this once again. Bam! Now, that looks like it happened in a split second for us, right? But if you were to slow that down, normal video, this is about 30 frames a second. If you were to slow that down to around 900 frames a second, you would see something entirely different. It doesn't go bam, it goes like a machine gun. And this whole complicated mechanism is built inside the bombardier beetle, and it completely defies evolution. Because think about it. The very first time this beetle slowly evolved the ability of these two chemicals, and it didn't have the two chemicals separated by a wall of chambers, then those chemicals would mix together and the beetle would explode. No evolution there. Everything had to have been in place at the same time in order for it to function. So, at this point, we've seen how it's possible for something like this to happen. What if you gave it a lighter, one additional mechanism in Leviathan? A lighter or an igniter that would ignite the chemicals as it came out of the dragon's mouth, then you've got a fire-breathing dragon. Not a far stretch at all. But, again, unless we see anything like this, it's hard to believe it ever existed. Has Leviathan been found? Well, in the same paleontological dig in Kansas, we found a portion of a mosasaur skull. Now, a mosasaur is a massive marine predator like a dinosaur, but it lives in the water. And they found them over 60 feet long. It's this giant serpent-like dragon, very close to what the Bible describes as Leviathan. So has Leviathan been found? We don't know, but this could be a relative of Leviathan here. The Bible knew best all along. Jonah 2 says, the waters compassed me about. I went down to the bottoms of the mountains, talking about when he was in the belly of the big fish. Well, does the Bible know best? That sounds pretty far-fetched, but yes, there are underwater mountains and ridges in the oceans. These mountains were first charted, though, in the 1950s. not during the time of Jonah. Yet Jonah is talking about seeing them or reporting them in the mountains underwater when he's in the belly of the fish. And in fact, if you look at the Mediterranean itself, closer to where he would have been, you can see in these maps some of these subsea ridges that he might have seen. Again, the Bible knows best. Job 36 says, "Behold, God is great, and we know him not. Neither can the number of his years be searched out." Now listen to the description here, and you tell me what you think this is. "For he maketh small the drops of water. They pour down rain according to the vapor thereof, which the clouds do drop and distill upon man abundantly." Amos 9 says, "He that calleth for the waters of the sea, and then poureth them out upon the face of the earth, the Lord is his name." Ecclesiastes 1 says, "All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again." Job 37 says, "Dost thou know the balancings of the clouds, the wondrous works of him which is perfect in knowledge?" What's it talking about here?
Water cycle.
The hydrologic cycle, the water cycle. That's exactly right. But you know, the water cycle wasn't even proposed until 1580. Ancient Greeks, during the same time that the biblical scripts were written, believed that rain was insufficient to feed springs and rivers. They said, this can't work. The Bible said, yes, it can. Because it was inspired by the Creator who designed the hydrologic cycle for that very reason. Again, the Bible knew best long before we figured it out. Job 38, "Hast thou entered into the springs of the sea, or hast thou walked in the search of the depth?" We now know that there are hydrothermal vents or hot springs in the deep sea that actually contain diverse life. It's amazing. We couldn't get down to these things until very recently, a few hundred years ago. But, you know, even this has been stripped of God's glory, because a lot of evolutionists are now proposing, yes, you know, it seems that Job 38 is springs in the sea. We do find springs in the sea. But the life that we find around those springs, that must be where life originated, because it's so diverse, and slowly that life turned into a fish, wandered into the ocean, crawled up on land, turned into a bird, turned into an ape, and turned into us. And so even that, it points us back to the Creator, and they've taken that and they've said, well, perhaps this is where evolution started. And Psalm 8 says, "What is man that thou art mindful of him? Thou madest him to have dominion over the works of thy hands. Whatsoever passeth through the paths of the sea, O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is thy name in all the earth." Well, Matthew Fontaine Maury was known as Pathfinder of the Seas. He lived in the 1800s. And story goes he was extremely ill one day. And his sister came into his bedroom, and she sat down beside his bed, and she was reading to him from the Psalms. She got to Psalm 8, and she said, "Whatsoever passeth through the paths of the sea." And he sat up in bed, and he said, "If I ever get over this, if I ever get well, I'm going to figure out what the paths of the sea mean." Well, that he did. And in fact, it turned out to be a whole lot more complicated than we could ever imagine. He charted all of the ocean currents and the paths of the sea that ships still use today. They still follow these same current paths today. And a monument in Virginia was inscribed in his honor. It says, "Matthew Fontaine Maury, Pathfinder of the Seas, the genius who first snatched from the oceans and atmosphere the secret of their laws. His inspiration, Holy Writ. The Bible knows best." And this is one more map, just to show you how complicated it can get. Again, predicted in Psalm 8, talked about, this is truly amazing. Isaiah 40 talks about, "It is he that stretcheth out the heavens as a curtain." Zechariah 12, "The burden of the word of the Lord, which stretcheth forth the heavens and layeth the foundation of the earth." So what's this talking about? Well, in 1912, Esto Slipper, using the Lowell Observatory Telescope in Flagstaff, was able to measure an apparent recession of spiral galaxies through Doppler shift, redshift, basically. Now, he didn't realize the implications of that finding until others came after him. But basically, here's a little example here. Doppler effect, you've heard it, a siren or a train whistle or anything like that. You hear the pitch shift as it passes you, right? Basically, you have waves here, it's same thing, it works the same way for light, except light is measured in nanometers of wavelength, but you've got a red shift based on the movement away from a central body. So, it did seem to have a red shift far galaxies in the universe. But what does that mean? Are the galaxies moving away from us? Well, in 1927, a Jesuit priest by the name of Georges Lemaître in Belgium proposed that the apparent recession of galaxies might be explained by the expansion of the universe instead of randomly galaxies just flying away from us, right? So in other words, perhaps the entire universe is expanding outwards, and the galaxies as a whole are moving outward with the fabric of space, and we looked at the fabric of space at the very beginning. So he took that idea, though, and the biblical principle of the fabric of space being stretched out like a curtain, and he took it too far. He took it to the extreme. So he said, maybe if we calculate back several billion years and it's moving out this way, we could put it all back together into a cosmic egg. And that was the first time that the Big Bang was proposed, called the cosmic egg. So in 1929, Edwin Hubble, whom the Hubble Space Telescope is named after, confirmed Lemaître's findings, and he calculated the values, and it became known as Hubble's Law. So, yes, it did indeed seem to be a stretching of the heavens, an expansion of the universe. So the idea of an expanding universe began to gain popularity, but it had its critics. In fact, 1949, the English astronomer Fred Hoyle, who believed in the steady-state theory, which is basically a matter is spontaneously generated, it magically appears to form the gaps where things are moving outwards, and he mocked the Big Bang theory. He's very critical of the idea, and he mocked it on BBC and called it this Big Bang idea. Well, it caught on. It was the first time Big Bang had ever been used, and that became what we know today as the theory of the origin of the universe. So during this time, Albert Einstein was working on a model to modify his theory of general relativity because he thought that the steady-state theory was correct. And he said, well, my theories don't quite calculate out if the steady-state theory is correct. But the new discovery of an expanding universe said, wow, now all of the values work perfectly. So he actually traveled to Mount Wilson to congratulate Hubble and said, you've just saved me a lot of trouble. So this is how the whole idea of the Big Bang came to be, but that's a stretch of the imagination, that 14 billion years ago, everything was a result of an explosion or a rapid expansion of space-time that sent matter and energy reeling outwards. The bottom line is the scientific data does seem to be pointing to a Doppler shift, a red shift, in outside galaxies. But it's not surprising at all because in multiple instances, at least four times in the Bible, for sure in Isaiah, it talks about the stretching out of the heavens like a curtain. The Bible knows best. I mean, so far so good. It's held up to the good science test, don't you think? Well, let's take a look and see if the same thing holds true for evolution.
Merriam-Webster defines religion as a cause, principle, or system of beliefs held to with ardor and faith. Evolutionists believe many things. They believe that there was a non-guided Big Bang 14 billion years ago. They believe that this proposed event caused the formation of all the stars and planets. They believe that humans evolved over millions of years from a chance mixture of all the right elements. However, the dictionary indicates that to be a religion, these beliefs must be held to with faith. Isn't evolution fact? Well, not any of those beliefs are fact. Good empirical science is observable and repeatable. No one witnessed a Big Bang 14 billion years ago, and we haven't been able to duplicate anything like it through testing in the lab. There have never to date been any confirmed observable reports of a star forming. This would take thousands or millions of years to actually document, is highly theoretical, and taken by faith. We have never been able to create life from non-life in the lab, despite millions upon millions of tests in the most favorable conditions possible. This is also a faith-based belief. All of these beliefs take a lot of faith, and their proponents hold to them with ardor. What does that make evolution? I'm David Reeves. Truly, the heavens declare the glory of God.
When you think about it, evolution is its own religion. And it's a dangerous religion because it leads us away from the truths of our Creator. The truths that tell us that in the beginning, God created everything we see around us, and He created it with purpose, with order, with design, and, of course, the purpose of us, to glorify Him, to be with Him. Now, I don't want to take too much more time. We may run a couple of minutes late, if that's okay, but I want to tell you about a couple of projects that I'm working on, and then we'll get to the last point that we want to talk about, in which we'll employ our miniature telescopes. The Creation Club. The Creation Club is a website that I formed about a year ago that gives biblical creationists a place to share and learn. In just a year's time, we have over 500 articles relating to creation, evolution, and science from contributors all around the world who send it in. We have a gallery of nature photography, of creation photography. We have, I think, 200 translated articles into Russian, French, Romanian, Spanish, Portuguese, Tagalog, some others. It's really been a blessing. It's taken off over the last year, and it's highly searchable. So you can plug in your question on the website, and more than likely, out of hundreds and hundreds of articles, your answer is going to be on there. So if you want to check that out, it's thecreationclub.com. We also have a weekly newsletter, e-newsletter, for free, called the Creation Weekly. And in that, I send out once a week a free article, a link to my WorldNet Daily Commentary, which is some of the two-minute commentaries that we've played throughout today, a link to my TV show, and some other things. So before you leave, be sure to put your email address and name on one of these little cards that we've got in the other room, and we'll make sure that you get these. It's a really powerful resource that you can use. We're trying to help spread the word. Also, like our Facebook page if you do that kind of thing. My brother works with me in the ministry. He maintains our Facebook and other social media. It's David Reeves Ministries. We also have a weekly TV show. I was down in Florida about to walk out of my hotel room about 2 years ago, and I got a call on my cell phone, and I said, well, I don't really have time for this. I answered the phone. Long story short, TBN, Trinity Broadcasting Network, the largest Christian network in the world, was calling, and they said, David, would you like to have your own television program? And I said, let me think about this for a second. Yes. So I went out, I taped a pilot episode. They liked what they saw, so it's on its second season right now. I've interviewed so many remarkable people. This is Dr. Chuck Thurston, an ER doctor, talking about the complexity of the human heart. Paul Taylor used to be Answers in Genesis UK division manager. Now he heads up a creation museum in Washington State. Eric Hoven from Pensacola, Florida, shared his method of reaching atheists with the gospel. I invited Dr. Jason Lyle, astrophysicist with Institute for Creation Research, to discuss the speed of light and the light travel time problem. Dr. Rusty Mazel, a Bible history expert, he brought a full working replica of a Gutenberg press, but half as big as a car. And we printed a page from the Gutenberg Bible on location live on the show. It was incredible. Mike Snavely, he grew up in South Africa. He now takes what he calls creation safaris to South Africa, showing the wide variety of animals over there and how they proclaim creation. Dr. Georgia Purdom, biologist with Answers in Genesis, she took a trip to the Galapagos Islands, where evolutionary theory was basically born, and showed how everything there points back to creation, not evolution. Dr. Danny Faulkner, astronomer, talking about extrasolar planets and extraterrestrial life. So we did several programs. The filmmaker Benjamin Owen, who produced the documentary Refracted Glory that I showed a clip of to start with, the Hummingbird documentary. Dr. Henry Morris III, CEO of the Institute for Creation Research. We talked about the age of the Earth, several other issues. It was a really great program. Frank Sherwin, zoologist. We talked about Mount St. Helens being a result of a catastrophe and a proof of catastrophic flood geology. Relevance of Genesis with Steve Hamm, Ken Hamm's brother. Ken's going to be on the program soon once we can coordinate schedules. Russ Miller heads up tours to the Grand Canyon. I invited him to talk about the global flood evidence at the Grand Staircase. Dr. Tommy Mitchell, a medical doctor who used to practice in Nashville, Tennessee, right down the road from where my ministry is located. We talked about stem cell research and the human eye, things like that. And we did one behind-the-scenes episode with Dr. Paul Crouch right before he passed away, introducing the show. He was really passionate about trying to get this show on the air and let people know. So I'm thankful for the opportunity to reach literally millions and millions all around the world on 20,000 television stations, over 100 million households in America alone, with this biblical creation message. So it's called Creation in the 21st Century. You can find it on TVN on Wednesdays. And you put your email address down. I'll send you a link to that as well each week. But through the weekly TV show and our other efforts, we're trying to just scratch the surface of some of the remarkable things that leads us back to our Creator's glory and to the Bible. Now, I want to tell you about one more thing, and then I'll conclude. And this is brand new. About 4 months ago, I realized that we need to be impacting and reaching the younger generation with the truths of creation science. So I formed a Genesis Science Network, and it's a 24/7 TV channel that can be found online, live streaming for free on iOS, Apple devices, Android devices. It can be found on Roku. Some of you may not be familiar with Roku, but there's 10 million of those devices out there, and it's basically cable that runs through your internet. So it has 500 religious channels. And we're going to be, our channel name is Genesis Science Network. It should be launched here in the next week or two. But I'm not putting it in the religious category. I'm putting it in science and technology. So we're going to be reaching not just the people who want to know about this type of material, but the people who need to know. I want to play you a little clip right now from the network. Hello, I'm David Reeves, and I'd like to welcome you to Genesis Science Network, the world's first and most comprehensive television network dedicated to the subjects of creation, science, and the Bible. GSN offers 24 hours of inspirational and informative programming that appeals to audiences of all ages. From technical dissertations delivered by PhD scientists to fascinating and easy-to-understand shows and documentaries that parents can trust, you'll find it here on Genesis Science Network. Astrophysicists currently believe that 95% of the universe is comprised of dark matter and dark energy. Now, these same scientists also explain that the reason it's called dark matter and dark energy is because it's dark, literally invisible. This means that according to our top scientists, we still haven't figured out how to observe any more than 5% of what's out there. With this humbling realization, it's obvious that science still has plenty to learn. Curiosity leads to discovery, and we need more of that. By studying the science behind what we observe all around us, we're constantly amazed at the wonderful design and function, from the tiny atom to the animal kingdom to the grandeur of the universe. We hope that the next generation of astronomers, paleontologists, geologists, and biologists will be taking a closer look at where the evidence is leading.
Good empirical science is the key, and that's what you'll find when you watch. Whether you're 9 or 90, whether you want to be educated or inspired, you'll find it all right here. Thanks for taking the journey with us as we discover the astounding science that leads us back to Genesis, the Genesis Science Network.
I'm pretty excited about this. I think that this is going to have a major impact on people who need to know. And it's been in process of development for a couple of months now, but again, ready to release in about a week or so. And it's already available online, streaming for free. We want this to be free so that anybody can come in and learn about creation science. I'm going to need people's help. This is something that we can't do alone. The monthly bandwidth costs and other development fees are ongoing. So if you're interested in supporting this project, please get with me. We're going to need monthly partners to keep this on the air, but it does have the potential of changing the entire scheme of things. Spurgeon, Charles Spurgeon, the famous pastor, said that one day people will look at evolution as the most foolish notion to ever cross the human mind, and children will laugh at it. And I think that that is possible, but this is my little attempt at getting that information out there. And we've already have signed contracts with Answers in Genesis, Institute for Creation Research, Creation Ministries International, Job Martin, Awesome Science Ministries, Awesome Science Media, and the list goes on and on. And they said, David, you can air any of our video, any and all of our videos on the network. That's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours of content that will be broadcast for free on Genesis Science Network. Now, as we conclude, we've looked at a lot of things so far. In fact, I'm running a little over time, and I apologize for that, but we've looked at the origin of science, the origin of time, space, and matter, the atomic structure of the universe, DNA and the complexity of life, hummingbirds and the Arctic tern, the blood is life, mountains and the ocean, springs in the sea, the paths of the sea, germ theory, separate disease from the camp, use running water, earth is a sphere, earth hangs on nothing. Behemoth and Leviathan are real, geology confirms the global flood, the hydrologic cycle, the stretching of the heavens. And we talked about others. So many different topics today that tell us that the Bible knows best from beginning to end. But let's look at one last example. Is not God in the height of heaven, and behold the height of the stars, how high they are? The stars really high? Does the Bible know best? I think so. This is the Southern Cross over here. And right next to it, Alpha Centauri. The Alpha Centauri system, Proxima Centauri actually, is our closest star. It's about 4.2 light years from Earth. 4.2 doesn't sound like very far. You can say I could run 4.2 miles to the grocery store and be back in no time. But 4.2 light years, we're talking about something traveling light at 12 million miles a minute after an entire year. That's a light year. And this is 4.2. That means that if we were to jump on our fastest spacecraft, which is now on its way outside of the solar system as we speak, the Voyager and New Horizons spacecraft, 40,000 miles per hour, they're traveling as we speak, and yet it would take us 70,000 years just to reach our closest star. If we were to move out in the universe, the Eagle Nebula is still within our galaxy. It's about 7,000 light years from Earth, but it would take us 117 million years to reach what you see on the screen. The Great Hercules Cluster is hundreds of thousands of stars, and it would take us 419 million years to reach this. Our sister galaxy, our next closest galaxy, 2.7 million light years away, containing over a trillion stars, but it would take us 48 billion years to get there. Not going to happen. The Whirlpool Galaxy is the last one we'll look at. And this one is, of course, outside of our galaxy. The far distant reaches of the universe. Still not the farthest galaxy. But this would take us 500 billion years to reach, traveling the speed of our fastest spacecraft. There's something in Psalm 19 that says, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork. It says that day unto day uttereth speech, and night after night showeth knowledge. But there is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. So the heavens are telling us something, but mostly they're telling us of God's glory. And when we see a glimpse of His glory, it's truly remarkable. Genesis 15 says, "Look now toward heaven and tell the stars if thou be able to number them." We can't number them. Did you know we've tried, the astronomers have tried to estimate the number of stars in the observable universe? Best estimates so far come to around 10 sextillion. That number is 10 with 21 zeros after it. I know we had some people come in afterwards. Who does not have a miniature telescope? Raise your hand.
There you go. There's one for you. One for you. There you are.
Has everybody got one now? Okay. All right. Now these have a little...
Don't have
them
yet.
Yep. There we go.
There you are.
Yes. Now these have a little crimp in the center crease, so they are hollow though. They're a little bit smaller than normal, but this is about right. So we read in Jeremiah 33 that the host of heaven cannot be numbered. That doesn't stop us from trying to number them, of course, because we always like to do things like that. And good science, you know, we're trying to figure out what's out there. But the Hubble Space Telescope decided to take a picture in a dark area of the sky that is just about as big as what you can see through the tiny hollow area in your miniature telescope. But what I want you to do is point it towards this star field right here and try to find the star through at arm's length. Hold it at arm's length and try to find a star. It's going to be extremely difficult to do. But if perchance you can find a star, then move in between two stars, where all you see is the blackness of space. The Hubble Space Telescope took a picture in a dark area of sky, and it took an 11-day exposure. So for 11 days, it kept the shutter open to try to accumulate enough light to see if maybe they had missed something in that dark area. And after 11 days, what they saw through an area just as big as you can see through your miniature telescope was this. 10,000 galaxies. Not stars. Galaxies. And each one of these galaxies contains several hundred billion stars. And you can take this outside at night and hold it up anywhere in the universe, in the night sky, and think about that. And be amazed and astounded, because truly, the heavens declare the glory of God. There's no way we can number these stars, but there is someone who can. In fact, Psalm tells us that He tells the number of the stars, and He also calls them all by name. When you think about that, there's a verse in Job that says that God does great things past finding out, yea, and wonders without number. This is just a glimpse. Just a small glimpse. Now Isaiah 51 says, "The earth shall wax old like a garment, and they that dwell therein shall die in like manner." Hebrews 1 says, "All shall wax old as doth a garment." Romans 8 says that the whole creation groans. So things are winding down. Things are getting worse. They're disintegrating, just like a garment. Increasing entropy. They're becoming more random. They're cooling off. Loss of usable energy. That's the second law of thermodynamics. That's what it states. So that's true. And in 2 Peter it says, "The day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in the which the heavens shall pass away with a great noise, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. The earth also and the works that are therein shall be burned up." But then it gives us something to look forward to, because that sounded pretty bleak. It says, "Nevertheless, we, according to His promise, look for new heavens and a new earth wherein dwelleth righteousness." Hebrews 3 says, "For every house is built by some man, but he that built all things is God." Think about it. If you're going through a forest and you happen upon a clearing, and you see a cabin in the clearing, do you say, "Oh, well, look, a tornado must have come through, the trees must have fallen over in a cabin shape, and then sand built up around it, and then lightning struck it, formed the windows of the cabin, and then boughs fell on top and formed the roof? No. No, you say it's obvious. It's self-evident. Every house is built by some man. But if that is evident, then it should be even more evident that when we look around us in nature, everything we see was created by God. Jesus himself said that if you can't believe the words of Moses, you can't believe in him. He says that Moses wrote them. So if you can't believe what Genesis tells us, then the entire gospel message is compromised. That's the reason that creation versus evolution is such an enormous issue in this day and age, because we can tell them all day long about God's plan of salvation, what he has done for us, but then if we say, but you don't have to worry about this over here, that's not real, that's just fairy tales, you know, then everything is compromised. But again, as we've seen today, the Bible knows best. The Bible is the Word of God, and God certainly knows best. He knew it all from the beginning, and he's given us the mental capacity to discover, to use science to relate these things to what we see around us. And they all point back to him. But if the Bible is true, and the Bible is the Word of God, then what does the book of John tell us about the Word? It says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. That's right. And it says that the Word became flesh and dwelt among men. That means that the Word is Jesus. That Jesus has been since the beginning. He is the creator of heaven and earth. That's what's so important. Because we've just looked at a glimpse of the heavens. And we've seen how marvelous and grand they are and how unfathomable. But amongst the unfathomable nature of the universe, this little speck, this tiny piece of rock floating in space that we call Earth, God sent his only Son down here to save us of our sins and offer us eternal life with him. And that's what's important. In a world that shuns absolutes, I'm going to take a leap of faith here and say that the Bible is absolutely true from beginning to end. And the Bible knows best. Thank you, George. Thank you, everybody. I appreciate you letting me come out and speak.